50, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's Brett Johnson with you on your Friday afternoon. And as Mike McEntee used to say every Friday, congratulations, you survived another week of the Trump administration. So heads up, today's show is actually pre-recorded, and here's why. As I've told you before here on the show, I do professional live streaming of sports and other events, and tonight I got contracted to stream professional wrestling. I am going to be out at the Bloomington Event Center streaming Steel Domain Wrestling's Halloween taking place tonight. And if you're not up to anything, I highly encourage you to head over to the Bloomington Event Center. The doors open at 6:30. Bell time is 7 o'clock. I've streamed a number of events for these guys, and independent professional wrestling is absolutely fun to watch, and it's great for all ages as well. So, well, you can see me out there too, running the live stream of that and getting the broadcast all set up. So that's tonight over at the Bloomington Event Center, Steel Domain Wrestling Halloween. Definitely encourage you to head out there if you're not up to anything this evening. All right, let's get to the content of today's show. Coming up, we're going to be talking about universal basic income because there is a rally that has to do with UBI tomorrow in Minneapolis, and we're going to be speaking with one of the organizers, Brett Buckner, coming up in the second half of the show. But in our first half, we are going to be talking about the success of labor strikes recently here in this country, because as I brought up on yesterday's program, we've seen a spike in labor strikes over the past year or so, and a lot of them have actually been successful in terms of workers winning better wages, better benefits, and better conditions overall, especially in the healthcare field. So we're joined now by Suzanne Gordon. She's a healthcare journalist and researcher. She is the co-author of Safety in Numbers, Nurse to Patient Ratios, and the Future of Healthcare. And more recently, she also wrote Wounds of War, How the VA Delivers Health Healing and Hope to the Nation's Veteran. And recently, In These Times, for that publication, she wrote a piece talking about how healthcare workers have won improvements due to strikes. So, Suzanne, thanks so much for joining us on the program today and talking about this important issue.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So, in your piece, In These Times, you talk about how, well, at least one of your specific examples happened in Chicago, where you talk about how National Nurses United went on a one-day strike at the University of Chicago Medical Center. And in response to the strike, management locked nurses out of the hospital for 4 days. And we've, of course, had similar situations here in Minnesota ourselves. We actually had a big situation with a Minnesota nurses strike in Duluth and also in the Twin Cities. And going back to Chicago, we had ownership accusing the nurses of being reckless and endangering patients. But nurses, of course, need to be well-trained and well-paid. So talk a little bit about how you were inspired to write this piece, because we've seen more and more of these movements around the country of nurses having to strike to get better care and also get better wages so they can care better for their patients.
Yeah, and it's not just nurses, Brett, that have gone on strike and engaged in action. In the piece, I also focus on an ongoing struggle right here in California where mental health professionals at Kaiser Permanente have gone on strike and also engaged in a public campaign about problems with shortages of mental health professionals in Kaiser and delays in care. It's resulted in the state fining Kaiser $4 million and monitoring its staffing. So nurses aren't the only health care professionals who actually go on strike or go on public actions, right. And invariably when they do, management, rather than examining and reflecting on its own, you know, often profit-driven behavior, accuses nurses of jeopardizing patients when, in fact, it's often management priorities that lead to these actions. And in the case of the University of Chicago Medical Center, management, accused nurses of being reckless and shameless. And, you know, in my experience, whether it's psychologists or family or social workers at Kaiser or represented by the National Union of Healthcare Workers or nurses represented by different nursing unions like the National Nurses United, these people often wait way longer to take action that they should have taken way sooner, and in a way almost enable poor patient care. It's a very difficult decision for people to go on strike or go public or wage a campaign against very powerful employers.
Yeah, and there's certainly a lot to unpack. Let's start with, some of these healthcare workers that you're talking about that, well, they are so dedicated to their patients. I've run into this situation before working as an accountant, actually, in the healthcare industry and just talking to some of these healthcare workers, whether they're nurses or they're doctors, where sometimes you actually kind of forget to care about yourself because you're so concerned about your patients, and they really do use strikes as a last resort, but sometimes it actually is necessary.
Well, I mean, there's, you know, cases here. I mean, I talked to, I think it was a monitoring tech who's, and again, this was in the National Union of Healthcare Workers located in Emeryville in Northern California. And this worker was, was tethered to monitoring all these complex, machinery, video screens that monitor patients' vital signs, and they didn't have enough staff, and the person actually wet their pants because they couldn't go to the take a bathroom break. I mean, nurses have a lot of urinary retention injuries and incontinence because they can't take a bathroom break, and they're constantly holding it in. You're not supposed to hold it in, when it says it's time to pee, you're supposed to pee.
Right.
And this is, and they put up with this, and then finally, they take some kind of action. In California, the California Nurses Association was responsible for. It took them 13 years, but they have the first safe staffing legislation, first and only bill in the country that protects patients. So, the question really is, why is management not listening to frontline caregivers? It's almost never about the money, and even if it is about the money, why shouldn't nurses or mental health professionals or housekeepers or whatever in hospitals and healthcare facilities, nursing homes are notorious for low pay for their nursing assistants, why shouldn't they go on strike for better wages? I mean, the people at the top are making millions of dollars. I mean, Bernard Tyson, who's the head of Kaiser, he earns $16 million a year. Is he worth it? Is anybody worth it, that much money? And top executives make a fortune, and people, at the front lines of care, taking care of incredibly sick people, mentally ill people, whatever, are paid, way, way less, if not a pittance.
Well, Suzanne, you've been writing about the rights for healthcare workers for many years. Has it always been like this, or is this something that's been more recent with the sorts of mergers we've been having?
I think you have a profit-driven healthcare system, and in a profit-driven healthcare system, patients don't come first. It's not that these managers or corporate CEOs get up in the morning and, think about how can I, mess around with patients today. It's that they work in a system that favors institutional survival and profit over patient care. And so as long as we have that kind of system, I mean, that's why I'm for a national health system or some kind of Medicare for All system with both of these unions, the National Nurses United and the NUHW, are supporting. Because if you have profit as your dominant motif, then you're going to try to cut back on staff, et cetera. We also have a broader problem in our society, which is that we're not we have old, a society that's aging and finally is recognizing more mental health problems in the case of Kaiser mental health staff. And we're not producing enough staff. And, one of the reasons why we're not is because people hear about the difficulties that people have being nurses or mental health professionals, and they don't want to go into that work. So it becomes a kind of vicious cycle. And I think that also the way that management approaches these workers when they make legitimate complaints and this totally dismissive attitude that you're kind of making it up, you're malingering, you're acting in your own self-interest. First of all, what's wrong with acting in your own self-interest in a country like this where it's all about individual advancement? A, and B, they aren't acting in their own interest exclusively. They're acting in the interest of their patients.
And that was part one of our conversation with Suzanne Gordon. Coming up on the other side of our break, it'll be part two. Welcome back to AM 950. It's Brett Johnson on your Friday afternoon, and a reminder that today's show is pre-recorded. Let's get back to our conversation with Suzanne Gordon, talking about the success of the labor movement in the healthcare industry. Hey, we've been speaking with Suzanne Gordon. She's a healthcare journalist and researcher, and you can find her recent piece about how healthcare workers have won improvements from striking in these times on that publication. Do you think a lot of this has to do with the fact, and I just go to my own personal example, where for a few years I contracted as an accountant for a hospice company here in Minneapolis, and I remember my first few weeks on the job. They were very stressful because, well, I was doing some very, you know, hard-nosed kind of accounting work, but I never actually got to see the patients or see the workers. It gets very easy to get caught up in balance sheets and income statements. Absolutely. And just viewing everything as a number, where I can see how that happens when you get more and more mergers, where you get more and more disconnected from the workers and the patients, where you don't realize what's actually happening. So it's easy when someone's saying, hey, we need higher wages or we need more time for breaks. It's easy to dismiss that and say, well, that's going to affect our income statement. It's going to affect our balance sheet. It's just, do you think a lot of this is just the fact that some of these executives, as you say, they don't intentionally try to make conditions miserable for their workers. It's just they're looking at balance sheets and income statements and not really making that human connection.
It's focusing on profit, not on patients. And, you know, even if they were walking the halls of their hospitals, which they're mostly not, you know, they're encapsulated in their own C-suite bubble. And they also have, you know, huge, I mean, you know, their bonuses, their salaries are tied to the kind of, you know, profits or, you know, that in some cases focus on medical research, not on real patient care as it's happening on the front lines. And, you know, and they're not incentivized to listen to frontline workers to solve problems, you know. And in the case of managers in America, I mean, you know, people are often fired if their staff forms a union, as though that having a union, which is a, you know, should be an American thing, it should be American as opposed to un-American, you know, because giving people a voice is American. And instead, it's viewed as a failure of management when you have a union. Why is that a failure of management? Unions can be very productive partners if you listen to them. They know what's going on at the front lines. They can help solve problems. I've done a lot of work in patient safety, and you invariably see when you make advances in patient safety, it's because you've gone to frontline workers and said, how could this be improved in your view? And they have the solutions because they're doing the work. Sitting in some C-suite far away from the direct provision of direct care does not give you insight into the things that need to be done to improve care, and hiring some consultant for $750 an hour doesn't do you much good in the same vein. But if you actually went down to your workers and listened to them, these hospitals that say they don't have enough money to hire more staff, I mean, in the case of the University of Chicago, they just spent $269 million on building some new building. The amount of money they pay on consultants, on administrative salaries, it's enough to staff huge hospitals fully.
Absolutely. And just going back to what I was talking about, too, in my example, when I actually had the chance a few weeks into my job to speak with some of the nurses, speak with some of the people who did therapy, speak with some of the people who did end-of-life care, my perspective kind of changed on what they actually do. So I think that's a step in the right direction, as you said as well, making sure that having a union is not seen as a negative for management. And ultimately, I'm with you. We do need a nationalized healthcare system to ultimately make improvements. But those are certainly steps in the right direction. But what do you think we need to do to, at least in the short term, make unions for healthcare workers stronger in this country?
Well, I think that the presidential candidates like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have proposals for you know, allowing workers to join unions by putting in a majority of signed cards instead of forcing them to have an election in which management always has an advantage and tries to intimidate workers, giving workers first contracts. We have situations in which people win a union and the hospital or health facility won't even negotiate a first contract. It drags on forever. We have a society. Whereas Alexis de Tocqueville said, you know, you had institutions in civil society that strengthened the society, and you have this paradoxical situation where we view those as illegitimate. I mean, I don't understand why people don't like unions. I mean, you football players have unions, you know, screen actors have unions, people who are making a lot of money have unions, and we see the decline of unionism both in healthcare and in the rest of the country, and this huge rise in income inequality where, you know, in the 50s, CEOs were making 20 times, you know, the lowest paid worker, and now they're making, I don't know, between, you know, 300 and 400 or even 700 times the lowest paid worker. That's completely inexcusable. I mean, many years ago I was doing research on a guy called John Rowe, who was a doctor who was the CEO of Aetna, and we looked at his salary and figured he was making something like $18,000 an hour. And, you know, his one day of his salary could pay for the salaries of three nurses. And, I mean, we just have to look at those questions. Do people need that much money? I mean, could he survive on $8,000 an hour? I mean, I don't know if I could. Really, $8,000 an hour wouldn't get
only
very far.
Yeah.
I mean, but it's just ludicrous. Mm-hmm. And we as a society aren't asking these questions. Now, you know, we should ask these questions when it comes to Amazon, but we should really ask them when it comes to hospitals, because these are very sick people in hospitals. They need people who are well-paid, who, you know, get time for their breaks. And, you know, you shouldn't, as a condition of working to save the lives and health of the people you care for, you shouldn't be asked to sacrifice your own life and health. That is unacceptable, in my view, and that's what we ask people to do. I mean, you listen to these psychologists and social workers and marriage and family counselors at Kaiser in California, and they are unable to give a second visit to people who are youngsters who are cutting themselves or have suicidal ideas, or people who are depressed and anxious and can't function, and they need to be seen, but they can't. Kaiser hasn't got enough staff to give people follow-up appointments. The state has said that they have to see people, thanks to the union's actions, that they have to see people within, I don't know, 10 or 14 days of their first call. They have to get some kind of triage, you know, an assessment. But then they can't get them in for, you know, 6 weeks, 2 months. Well, people need to be seen right away, particularly people who've been struggling with mental health issues, have been afraid to get help because of the stigma of mental health. And finally, they get up the courage and they go, and then they have to wait for months. That's really just inexcusable when you could be hiring more people and dealing on a societal level to make sure that there's enough providers in the pipeline to give us the staff we need in 5 years, 10 years to come. You know, this is another issue that we aren't producing enough primary care doctors, we aren't producing enough nurses, we aren't producing enough psychologists and mental health workers. And you can't just turn on the spigot and have hot and cold running healthcare professionals come out. There's a, you know, 4 to 10 year lag time between your decision now to hire more people and producing the more people that you can hire. And we aren't dealing with that.
Hey, we've been speaking with Suzanne Gordon. She's a healthcare journalist and researcher, and you can find her recent piece about how healthcare workers have won improvements from striking in these times on that publication. Suzanne, thanks so much for taking the time to join us on the program today to talk about the importance of getting better work conditions for healthcare workers. Certainly very important, and really appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And coming up next, we're going to be talking about universal basic income, because there is a rally that is taking place tomorrow in Minneapolis that also is going to serve as kind of an informational session. We'll be speaking with one of the organizers, Brett Buckner, in just a few minutes. But first, the news. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's Brett Johnson on the Minnesota Progressive Repartee. Well, as we've seen during the presidential campaign and the Democratic primary, universal basic income has been an issue that's really been highlighted on the campaign trail, especially, of course, by Andrew Yang. And with the momentum for the movement behind universal basic income is a rally that's going to be taking place this Saturday at Acadia Pub in Minneapolis. It is the Basic Income Rally that is taking place. So joining us now on the program is someone who helped organize the event. It's Brett Buckner. Hey, Brett, how you doing today?
How you doing, Brett?
Excellent. Oh, we can't get too many Bretts on the program, can we?
No, we can. It's going to take me a minute before I start to say I'm eased into it.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. So tell us a little bit about this rally, again, taking place Saturday, 11 o'clock at Acadia Pub. Tell us how it got started, the idea behind it, and kind of the momentum that got started behind having this rally.
Yeah, sure. So there's a major rally that's taking place in New York City that is starting to call for the push of this very not so much new idea. This thing has been around for almost the founding of the country, where a lot of the some of the fathers of the country were thinking about this idea, and now it's just over 200 plus years. This time has come to really start to take it to the next level. So, on that day, on the 25th, we're going to be a part of a national movement. And again, it's not affiliated with any campaign. Let me be very clear about that. But yes, we do have a very strong proponent in Andrew Yang, who is, touting the conversation during the presidential debates and through the campaign. But it's just a group of citizens that are coming together who believe that this is a one way to strengthen the American economy and making sure, and most importantly, that we strengthen the economies of families of everyday Minnesotans.
Yeah, looking at the rally, it sounds like you're going to have a lot of basic information about it in case people aren't quite familiar, as well as a lot of speakers. Can you talk about what people can expect if they attend the rally?
Sure thing. So yeah, it will be giving the baseline for a lot of people who are new to the concept or just on the edge of, piquing their interest. But also, what's the next steps? How can it happen in the state of Minnesota? There are many trials that are taking place across the country right now, and we believe strongly that Minnesota should be next in that line to start testing it out and see if it works for our community and really start to get people engaged. So we'll have people who will speak to that, to those issues, as well as just answering the basic questions of what is basic income guarantee.
Well, let's actually dive right into that question. What overall, in your mind, is the definition of a universal basic income?
Well, it is pretty straightforward. It is the allocation of dollars from the general coffer, public coffers, to each and every individual. And again, this is where we get to have the fun conversation on who does that include. Some proposals have just 18-year-olds and up, 18 to 64. Others have universal, completely for everybody. So regardless of income, regardless on your class or whatever else, everybody gets it. So there's still major, debate points to start talking about. And that's part of the reason why we're pulling people together to do this larger education. So from my standpoint, universal, everybody gets it some way, somehow, and it comes out once a month to everybody, and the rates are going to be based on what the community agrees.
And as you talked about, there's certainly a lot of nuance and details that have to be worked out going by the proposal, because we've seen, well, let's talk about a situation which happened kind of in Alaska, where they call kind of those oil dividends that people receive kind of a form of universal basic income. What do you make of that situation, like in Alaska, and making sure that we don't actually have like a UBI actually substitute other social safety nets? Because one of the current concerns I've seen people have is that, well, in Alaska, they've kind of used that as an excuse to say, oh, well, we're going to cut our other social services.
And that's where the decision of the community in Alaska, for the state of Alaska and their residents, I don't agree with the way that they're going about it. And they're but they're also using the natural resource of their oil to fund their baseline UBI allocation, their dividend. In the state of Minnesota, I think there should be a combination of all. We can't do everything. But there are some things that we must do in order to make sure that we maintain the floor for all of our residents. And from my opinion, and again, you know, everybody has their point of view on this, but I believe our first and foremost responsibility is making sure that all Minnesotans are above the line of poverty. I mean, period.
Mm-hmm.
And what that does is it strengthens communities, it strengthens families, it strengthens communities, it strengthens our economy when we start to invest in ourselves. So that's the way that I would approach it. And the organization I am the managing director of, and the reason why we're part of this overall push to think about these new and creative ideas to strengthen our economy. So through 1MN, we're saying very easily, if we're able to raise everybody's level, I mean, it's the whole Wellstone approach. You know, we all do better when we all do better. You know, when we eliminate the concept of poverty within our state, think about what our community can do at that point in time.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm curious about the response you've gotten in Minnesota from the general community, or maybe even politicians themselves, because we've certainly seen this concept of UBI really highlighted over the past few months and even years with Andrew Yang kind of coming into the limelight. What have you been hearing from folks around Minnesota in terms of support or even opposition to UBI?
You know, we have a wide spectrum, and it's in the very polite way of Minnesotan. You know, in the Minnesota speak, that's interesting, I always would get. And interesting good, interesting bad, you know, from those perspectives. You know, there's still a lot of conversation to be had. We need to test it. We need to understand exactly what is the full benefit for it. But the simple fact is that our economy is going to change drastically in a very short amount of time. We'll need tools such as UBI and other things in order to make sure that we are able to live the lives that we believe we should live in the state of Minnesota.
And let's talk about that changing economy idea, because that's something that really kind of hits home for me. I mean, I, of course, work in the radio industry, and that has been hit very, very hard over the past few years and decades by automation. And then you look at other industries like people who are delivery drivers or truck drivers. That's certainly going to be automated as well. So talk about those sorts of benefits in terms of having a UBI.
No, that's a great point. Again, with what we're seeing right now, the Amazon effect, the high tech and large tech industry that is learning how to make our society a lot more efficient and effective, but is also leaving a lot of people behind. And we have known and we have lived through multiple depressions and recessions through, you know, the past century plus, that we know that we just can't leave people out. So the simple fact is that we have to have, you know, that floor stabilized to where we know that people are going to be able to succeed. And this is based off of real facts. We know that this thing works. And just, you know, north of us in Dauphin, Ontario, they had a study about 35, 40 years ago where it clearly showed when you were able to provide a basic guaranteed income for a community that a lot of things happen in the positive, lowering of the use of public health issues, the services, lowering of public safety issues, increase of education. You actually had an expansion of the economy. More people start to go to work. More people were actually more at ease. Stress started to was relieved as well. And these are the things that we should aspire to. It's not so much about, you know, can we get the accounting right? It's whether or not the question that we should be focusing on, what type of society do we want to live in, you know, going into the 21st century, to work alongside with our technology and this these new pieces of automation, so in, that ensures that our society is able to truly benefit from these great, you know, advances. I mean, again, there's a reason why it's called the freedom dividend, because we will be freed up to do some amazing things and live, you know, off of these great advances if we begin to work together and start to see ourselves as a part of a whole society as opposed to winners and losers. So that's what I'm looking forward to. I think Minnesotans will really get behind this once they really get the full scope and scale.
And coming up, we'll continue our conversation with Brett Buckner talking about UBI. But first, it's time for Artbeat for the Week. Welcome back to AM 950. Brett Johnson with you on your Friday afternoon. And let's get back to our conversation with the other Brett. Again, that's Brett Buckner talking about universal basic income. Hopefully you've been enjoying your invasion of the Bretts. We're speaking with Brett Buckner. He's one of the organizers of the Basic Income Rally, which is taking place this Saturday at 11 o'clock over at Acadia Pub in Minneapolis. So, yeah, one of the other benefits I like hearing about the universal basic income, because I've certainly started studying up on this myself since Andrew Yang kind of entered the presidential race, is that it frees people up to not be handcuffed to a certain job, which to me can really spark a lot of innovation where people aren't staying at one job that they may not like simply because they are getting a good healthcare plan. So I think that's certainly a good benefit as well.
Well, definitely. I mean, not only from a standpoint of, you know, the imagination would be freed up to do, but think about some key things that go on in our society, the exploitation of a lot of our citizens, mainly women, you know, in certain industries that now all of a sudden with that, you know, that with that floor, you know, to be able to say, you know, I don't have to deal with this. I can move on and do something else. It is the thing of making sure that basic needs are just actual, those things that are just out of reach a lot of times when parents, you know, families have to make that decision. I can pay for, you know, our medicine for this month, or I can make sure that my child is able to participate in that event. You know, you don't have to make those decisions if you have that real investment. And again, it's an investment in us. And there's multiple ways we can do the accounting that is going to be, you know, shared. But it's a shared prosperity initiative when we start thinking about this. So when we start thinking of it from the standpoint, I mean, I think Andrew Stern has the best phrase to this, and I'll use the PG version of it. But basically, it's the FU fund. You know, you don't have to deal with all the BS that you normally would have to do, but it also forces businesses to really raise their standards at their place. So if you're that restaurant and you and you know you got that great bartender or that server or whatever else, you have to be on point, because that individual, if you're not on your P's and Q's, can step away from you right away and go somewhere else and take their talents that way. So it is the ultimate, as others would say, the ultimate strike fund that people were able to stand upon. And I think it's in the best interest of us all. And I think the world is looking for us to adopt this thing and really start to lead on how to recreate our economy.
I do want to move on to one area where I sort of have a concern with UBI, and that's the fact that if we do implement something like that eventually here in the state of Minnesota or this country, I think it's important that we tie this to inflation, because at least one of the concerns I have is that I don't want it to turn into like a healthcare type voucher where all of a sudden if you get, let's take that healthcare voucher example that we've often heard proposed, where you get $500 of a healthcare voucher per month. Well, all of a sudden a health insurance company says, well, guess what? Everything's going to cost an extra $500. So talk about that aspect to make sure that it doesn't become something like a minimum wage where we get that freedom dividend, but then it's not raised for another 10 or 20 years.
Right. No, that's a great point, Brett. And what we are looking at across the board is, you know, basically it's creating the necessary balance so that those captains of industry or, you know, very creative individuals who would like to be able to, you know, stretch and maybe increase it, you know, just beyond, you know, cost of living to really pad their, you know, bottom line, that there's a full agreement within the whole society that as long as we stay balanced within each other, it's going to help out each other. I mean, the simple thing is that with UBI, it really stabilizes an economy, which is actually going to help everybody's bottom line if everybody is patient and willing to work with each other. So it is, I think that's going to be a very interesting policy conversation. I think definitely it's going to take all levels of government, even though it is, you know, disseminated by, you know, probably the largest entity, either the federal government or the state government. But the cities and the counties and others are going to have to say, we need to hold the line of our cost across the board in order to make sure that this is truly a benefit for everybody. Because if we do hold the line, you know, again, what the Roosevelt Institute has very clearly said, this means millions upon millions of new jobs if we just hold tight. And it's not just the soul-sucking type of jobs. We're talking about jobs that really stir the soul and start to move our society forward.
Exactly. And I'm glad we're having some conversations about this. And again, with your rally coming up on Saturday at 11 o'clock, Acadia Pub in Minneapolis, a chance to kind of hammer out some of these details and answer questions that people might have about universal basic income. Do have a couple more final questions for you here, Brett. Obviously, UBI has really been highlighted since Andrew Yang has entered the presidential race. But at least in terms of the movement for UBI, how do you make sure that it becomes bigger than just Andrew Yang and to make sure that the movement doesn't fade away when all of a sudden the 2020 campaign is over?
Most definitely. That's one of the reasons why we're doing the rally in the way that we're doing it. This is not about the individual. It's about the institution and the initiative that we have to focus on. This is in the best interest of all and not just the handful of individuals who may be behind a campaign. And this cross-section this partnership that has come together to start this process. And again, we're not going to stop with just this rally. We're moving into 2020 with our eyes deeply on the prize and going to the legislature to say that this is in the best interest of those left, right, center, wherever you're at across Minnesota. So we've been reaching out to other individuals, Republican Party members who actually get it, who actually see it, who have done their assessment and said, and ask the questions of how can we start to maybe rein in some of the public spending that we do on additional goods and services, or actually I'm looking more for welfare, but not trying to use the word specifically on that one for right now. But They're seeing it. I mean, they see the math. The math is pretty straightforward. If, think about it from this standpoint, a family of four, and that you have husband and wife in there, that's an additional $1,000, $2,000 from that standpoint. One of the conversations that we're having is, do the kids get a dividend? That is a possibility. Some people would like to give them $500 a month, et cetera, to take care of some key needs. So just think of it from that standpoint. That's an additional $3,000 going into each household, into that community. And Republicans are starting to say, well, that means they can go out to eat a little bit more. Maybe that means they can, you know, do this. They can do that. That adds to the tax base. So they get it. Libertarians are getting it because they want to be able to reduce the size of government and provide more freedom for people. And quite honestly, they want their money back in the first place. From the Democrats, you know, they see the ability to stabilize their families. So you see there's, you know, a consensus, not necessarily from their on the actual details to it, but a consensus of the idea. So that's what we're focusing on. We'll rally up the people starting on this Saturday at 11 o'clock at Acadia and start to move the idea from there.
And I just find that issue so fascinating in that you get people who are from the left and the right that actually agree on this issue, because it's very rare to find an issue like that where you actually do get people who come from completely polar opposite sides of the political aisle and kind of agree on a universal concept of UBI in some sense. That's definitely got to be kind of an interesting dichotomy to have people from both the left and the right kind of come together on a single issue like this.
It is amazing. I mean, especially when you start thinking about, you know, the names that over history that have put their names behind this thing. You know, Milton Friedman, you know, who is definitely not your left, you know, your left economist, is a strong proponent of this concept. Again, you know, how do you limit government and everything else? But on the other side, you do have individuals like Andy Stern, you know, the former labor leader for SEIU, you know, who's looking at it from the standpoint of this is a way to really re-empower, you know, the workers of the society. Robert Reich, former labor secretary, is getting behind this concept. And, you know, when you look at certain proposals and everything else, you know, put up by the Democrats, but I also think that some of the libertarians and even some of the, you know, far out, you know, those who are not necessarily mainstream Republicans right now, who are starting to think about this thing called, you know, stabilizing the economy, and making sure that people have enough money to be able to do what they need to do. Because, quite honestly, at the end of the day, our compassion and our humanity has to outweigh what has been taking place. We've made some missteps going from 2008. We're going into a hyper adjustment into our economy and the way that we're going to do work. What are the tools that need to take place? And at the end of the day, what we're talking about, how do we get cash in people's and people's pockets? Well, how do you make it acceptable by all? If I give, you know, someone like the Polads $1,000 and I give the person on the street $1,000, Polads ain't going to be screaming about how you got $1,000 and vice versa. Mm-hmm. The simple fact is that we're all in this together. And now we start to build an economy and go from there.
All right, Brett, unfortunately, we are close to running out of time. But one more time, give us the details of the rally coming up.
Sure thing. Thanks again, Brett, for the time. It's this Saturday, 11 o'clock, Acadia Pub, which is 329 Cedar Avenue South, Minneapolis, 55454, if you need to do some GPSing. And just go check us out on our Facebook page. I think you guys are putting that up as well. And we're just come on. Space is limited, so we want you to come. And if you don't, if you're not able to make it, send us a note. We'll keep you going because we're going to push UBI through in the state of Minnesota.
Yeah, and as you said, there's other ways to connect. As you said, via Facebook on the Minnesota Basic Income Rally. If you just search for that on Facebook, you'll find it. We'll also get that shared over to the AM950 page, or you can find national information, since there are some other rallies going around the country, at basicincomemarch.com. That's Brett Buckner. He is an organizer with the Basic Income March event in Minneapolis, which again takes place this Saturday, 11 o'clock at Acadia Pub. Hey, Brett, thanks so much for joining us on the program today. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks again for the time, Brett.
And that's all the time we have for today on the program. A reminder, tonight I am at Steel Domain Wrestling's Halloween at the Bloomington Event Center, as I'm the guy that's going to be out there doing the broadcasting. No, I certainly will not be getting in the ring, but little plug for them. If you're not up to anything, highly encourage you to go check it out. The doors open at 6:30, bell time 7 o'clock. Tickets are really affordable. So, yeah, there's my plug for Steel Domain Wrestling tonight at the Bloomington Event Center. All right, I'm back for the live show coming up on Monday. I'll talk to you then.